You may recall that Kol Nidre night on Yom Kippur, I spoke to you on the virtues, the character, that I believed would be required of all of us if we were to live successfully in the coming age, which I called the age of shortages. And I tried to make the point that night, that day, that it was entirely possible to have more and to be less. I cited as an example the great age of abundance which we had just passed through in America, which had left America with such a crying sense of aimlessness and of emptiness. And that conversely, it was possible to have less and to be more, provided one cultivated his own talents and spirit and human relationships, conserved his natural endowment in the very sense that we try and conserve the greater nature without. And I used that day as a symbol of wealth, oil, as a symbol of the shortages, the many shortages which will soon be upon us, oil. And I quoted to you that day the famous rabbinic dictum, Shem Tov Mishemen Tov, that it is better to have a good name than to have a great deal of oil, good oil. I tried to leave the suggestion then that an oil shortage or any shortage was not the end of the world, but in fact spelt possibility. The possibility of using our God-given endowments to a degree and with a refinement and a sensitivity which we had never exhibited before here in America. Now, I cite this lecture because it is a good beginning point for this morning. I wrote it before the Yom Kippur War. I delivered it before the Yom Kippur War. We talked of oil shortages before the October Arab-Israel conflict. And what I mean to underscore is simply this. The Arab-Israel confrontation in the Middle East did not cause the oil shortage, and therefore any solution, or the non-solution, of the Arab-Israel problems in the Middle East will not be the cure, the solution, to the oil crisis which is upon us. The oil crisis exists independently of Israel. And no amount of pressure on Israel, no amount of concessions by Israel will solve the oil crisis. Of course, when the great oil-producing states of the Arabian Peninsula met in Kuwait 3 weeks ago, at that conference where they decided to embargo all oil shipments to these United States and to reduce by 10% in the first month and by 5% every month thereafter the level of oil production which would be sent out to the rest of the world, they were acting in response to the timing of this latest Arab-Israel conflict. They were trying to encourage, to force, to blackmail world opinion, nations of the West particularly, so that they would force the Arab-desired concessions upon Israel. The timing of that conference had something to do with the October War. But that conference was in the making long before that war. Need I remind you that a year ago, King Faisal of Saudi Arabia called in his American lackeys, the so-called chief executives of our big oil-producing cartels, Aramco, Standard Oil of California, Mobil Oil, Texaco, and told these fine American citizens that they must show their dual loyalties clearly and openly and now. And he in fact ordered them to go beyond the private lobbying which all the oil companies have been engaged in for many, many years with the State Department and the administration and Congress, and now publicly to surface their demands that the United States look upon the Arab position with more favor than she had looked upon it before, and in fact give in to the Arab demands not only that Israel withdraw to the borders of 1967, but that Israel recognize the legitimacy of the rights of the Palestinians, which is simply a code word for the disestablishment of the State of Israel. And you'll recall that it was shortly after news of this conference in the capital of Saudi Arabia began to surface in the national news magazines that we began to get a series of advertisements in the public press sponsored by the oil companies, in which the key line was always the need for American even-handedness. And finally, we got that infamous letter from the president of Standard Oil of California, written to all the managers of gasoline stations that drew fuel from him and to all the stockholders of Standard of Oil, which said, in effect, your profits depend upon your willingness now to pressure the American government to look upon the Arab position in the Middle East with the same amount of concern, I'm using his words, that the American government has till now looked upon Israel's demands for the Middle East. There would have been a Kuwait conference, if not in October, in November, if not in November, in December. The Arabs had decided that now was the time to use oil as a political weapon. And they decided to use oil in order to extort political concessions from the West, not because of Israel, not because Israel was somehow so much a culprit after 1967 or because Israel was so intransigent, because now for the first time it made economic, fiscal sense for the Arabs to do this. If the Arab states can force the West, particularly the United States, to lean upon Israel, that will be a political plus for a financial decision, which would have been made in any case. But the simple facts are these. A barrel of oil in the ground in Saudi Arabia or Kuwait, a barrel of oil is equivalent to 55 gallons of oil, is worth more today to the Arab world than a barrel of oil above ground and sold. The Arab states, simply put, have come to that position where it is not profitable for them to produce more oil than they are now producing. As a matter of fact, it is advantageous for them to cut back from the high levels of production which the West has encouraged them to adopt up till now. The finance minister of Saudi Arabia said in an interview about 8 months ago that in 1972, his country had been able to use domestically only 62% of its oil profits. What were they to do with the other 38%, the millions upon tens of millions upon hundreds of millions of dollars? They were building roads, they were building hospitals, they were building some schools, but even so, they could use up only 62% of their total profits. What could you do with the rest? Bank it at a few percentage points? Invest it at a few percentage points? Most of that money was in dollars. And over the previous 2 years, the finance ministers had seen the value of these dollars depreciate by 20% as America devalued the dollar twice. In the ground, oil represents their future. Once it's exhausted, these states have nothing. They're Arab, desert, parched, hopeless pieces of real estate. In the ground, they represent potential profits, the future. Above ground, they represent what? Profits which partially can be plowed back into their economies. But it's not at all clear how much these feudal medieval states want really to develop, to modernize their economies. Imagine the social revolution that will take place in Kuwait or in Saudi Arabia or in Oman or in Abu Dhabi once the people become literate. What are they to do? Simply continue pumping oil for dollars they don't want because the United States and Western Europe need the oil? Or protect their investment? Protect their future? Abdul Rahman Al-Abteki, who is the oil minister of Kuwait, said about a year ago, "Why should I produce more oil and give it for unguaranteed paper money? Why should I produce oil, which is my own bread, my livelihood, and give it for a price which next year will be devalued by so many percent?" And there you have it. There is simply no inducement for these oil-rich states to produce more oil, and they can easily do so, or even to produce oil at the rate that they have been producing it up till now, because they do not want, they cannot use domestically the profits which are accruing to them. The little state of Kuwait had an income, a profit, not an income, but a profit, for every man, woman, and child of $12,500 last year. What they can do with this money? I could give them some suggestions. They might they not, give some of it to the terribly poor, the miserable fellahin of Syria and of Egypt and of Sudan and of Yemen. Share it among their Arab brothers. But that's not the Arab way. Do you know that Arab profits from oil in one day will exceed this year the amount of money that the Jewish community worldwide will raise for the UJA? Can you imagine what one day's profit of oil might mean for the so-called Arab refugees? How long they would have to remain in their misery if for one day their Arab brothers would be willing to share the profit they can't use with them, give them decent housing, decent schooling, and job opportunities in a home. It'd be so easy. But that's not the Arab way, unfortunately. So we have an Arab world, or rather the oil-producing countries within the Arab world, fearful that their Arab brothers who do not have oil will subvert them, will come in and conquer them, but at the same time trying to shake the West to do the Arab will against Israel. And on our side, we face this cutback, this inevitable cutback in Near Eastern oil production with bloated bellies. Morris Udall, the former Secretary of the Interior, called us oil pigs. And with an economy which has for 25 years been operating on the assumption that we would have an endless supply of cheap energy. After all, our geologists were telling us that there were oceans of oil under the Saudi Arabian subcontinent. And there was plenty of oil in Nigeria, and there was plenty of oil in Venezuela, and some in Indonesia. There was enough oil, and there were the great big tankers, and they could bring as much oil as we needed to our ports, and it would be piped here, there, wherever we needed, for those great big cars which gulp down oil as if it were an endless commodity. And so we allowed these oil cartels to tell us that we didn't have to develop our own domestic energy reserves. They would always bring enough oil to our shores, and it'd be cheap oil. In 1970, it cost 70 cents a barrel to pump oil out of the ground and to transport it to the shipping point. By 1975, it was estimated it would cost 75 cents a barrel. By 1980, 77 cents a barrel. It's simply not a very expensive undertaking. And in 1970, the cost of a barrel of oil was $1.70. In 1973, it's all of a sudden nearly $7. A barrel, and the cost can escalate endlessly. It's a seller's market. Everybody wants it. Everybody needs it. So America in these intervening years has decided that, no, we need air conditioning. We won't open windows anymore. And no, we don't need cars that travel 25 miles to the gallon. It's fine to have a great big car that gulps, you know, at 6 miles or 7 miles to the gallon. And yes, we're going to light up every piece of stone masonry which we ever built as a great edifice. We can't have dark streets. And we're going to light up every room in our house and let the energy burn on endlessly. And all of our utilities were telling us, you know, to put in a gas barbecue and new electric lights and to illuminate our buildings and to use and to be wasteful of all of our energy. We gave not one thought to the future. And you and I didn't give one thought to the future because our government didn't tell us to. And our government didn't tell us to because the great oil companies had it easy and wanted to keep it that way and were assuming that they always could. After all, what do these Arab sheiks know? Give them some television sets, take them to the Riviera, introduce them to the President of the United States, produce for them some luxuries. They'd produce for us all the oil we could possibly need. And as a result, the oil industry has invested very little in research and development. Oh yes, a great deal of money has been plunged into the looking for new wells in Saudi Arabia, but very little in the techniques to gasify coal, and proportionally very little in the techniques to turn nuclear power into electrical energy. And the oil energy has, in fact, the oil industries have, in fact, literally been engaged in a kind of negative advertising campaign tied in with ecology to tell us that we shouldn't be burning coal, we shouldn't be using other fuels because they'll pollute the atmosphere and it's too costly to go to the shale reserves and so on and so on and so on. The oil industry is a cartel. It's a great big international cartel which is designed to maximize its own profits for no other reason. It has no national patriotic side to it. And when the oil crisis first began to emerge into public view about a year ago, what did the great oil companies in the United States do? In the first instance, they seized the opportunity to turn off the spigot to most of the so-called independent oil fuel suppliers, the little gasoline stations, the ones that weren't tied into their monopoly. And the second thing they did was to try and find ways to get out of all of some of the less profitable contracts for the delivery of oil, the contracts to school systems, the contracts to the mass transit utilities and the like. And when this last embargo on oil was finally announced from this Near East towards the United States, what did they do? They began to talk very seriously and very intelligently about the need to pull in our energy-consuming belts, to drive less, to turn down the thermostats, to put up the storm windows, to turn off the electric lights. You know, all the things we've heard on the public radio and in the press, but they tied it almost entirely to the Middle East oil crisis, as if their own miserliness and greed and lack of foresight and lack of patriotism were not major elements, the major elements, in this whole sorry mess. To cite only our local situation, the major oil distributor in our area is Standard Oil, Ohio. And all week long, you and I have been reading in the public press of interviews with Alton Whitehouse, the president of Standard Oil, in which he's told us some very important things about the need for independence in American policy, about the need for a concern for the development of new oil reserves. But he's always tied it to the Middle East oil embargo as if somehow, you know, Israel and the war against Israel is the real cause of this oil shortage. And just Thursday, I noticed in our Plain Dealer a three-quarter column advertisement put intelligently, I must say, right next to the racing form, signed by Charles Spahr, the chairman of Standard Oil, in which in the print here, he speaks very intelligently, just as the President of the United States did the other night, about the need for, you know, us, all of us, to restrict our energy use. But the headline reads, Middle East oil embargo slows down Sohio refiners. And the other big print reads, the Middle East oil conflict and its resulting embargo on oil shipments to the United States have cut off Sohio from major sources of its crude oil. This has forced Sohio to reduce refinery output and the supply of gasoline to its retail outlets. You and I, Israel, are somehow guilty. Not a word here about the fact that in 1972, this major oil producer invested less than $250,000 in putting new wells for natural gas down in our own state. There's an estimated 3 trillion cubic feet of natural gas, not in Saudi Arabia, but under the state of Ohio. And Sohio has never invested time, money, or energy in the wells, in the techniques, in the pipelines, and most importantly, in building the storage facilities, which would have allowed it to bring in natural gas from our own sources or from elsewhere in the nation, store it during the summer so it could be pumped to our schools and to our office buildings and to our factories and to our homes during the winter. Not a word about its own short-sightedness, but only the sudden recognition that somehow the Arabs are now independent, that they have political and economic minds of their own, and that it's because of their business with Israel that Americans won't be able to do as profitable a business as before. Unfortunately, the oil companies have been interested really only in big profits. And the American government, which ought to have exercised a major the major responsibility, played the ostrich. Times were good. The oil companies were shipping the oil. There was enough for all of us. After all, look at how much we had. 6% of the world was consuming 33% of the energy output of the world. Why do we need to look to the winter, to look to the future? So our government didn't say a word, didn't really begin to develop a crash program for American domestic energy production until after the crisis was on us. It's a tragedy. Nature has been remarkably kind to these United States. It's we who have been unkind to our own future. You know, it's not Saudi Arabia, which is the major oil-producing nation in the world. It's these United States. We produce every day more oil, more gasoline than any other country on the face of the globe. And we have known oil reserves, 385 billion barrels. And that does not count the several trillion barrels of oil which exist in the shale deposits out in the West. We have in these United States something on the order of 2,000 trillion cubic feet of natural gas. We have in these United States enough coal to supply the energy needs of our own country for the next 200 years. And certainly we have the scientific manpower, the technology, which we would have invested the time, the energy, the money would allow us to find the ways to develop and to use all of these resources. But instead of that, we were greedy, short-sighted. We put all of our eggs in the Middle Eastern barrel. We imported 3.4 million barrels a day of oil from the Middle East in 1970, 3.9 in 1971, 4.5 million barrels in 1972, and this year we were importing oil at the rate of 6 million barrels of oil a day from the Middle East. And by 1980, if that trend had continued, we would have been importing half of our necessary oil supply from the Middle East. There are many oil experts. Suddenly now they're oil experts. They've all been singing the same song, but now suddenly some of them are telling us the emis, the truth. And some oil experts who say, thank God, the Arabs finally put it to the world, and that they put it to the world so early. Because in 7 years, they say, or in 10 years, with a crash program, America can again become energy independent, dependent upon its own oil resources, and own gas resources, own coal resources, own electrical resources, own nuclear energy resources. But if they'd waited 5 years or 8 years, then America almost could have been brought to her knees by the Arab action. So perhaps the Arabs in the long run have done themselves a disfavor. Perhaps. But one thing is clear, that their action, the recognition of the new energy picture which their action has brought to the fore so forcefully throughout the world, has sent shockwaves. And the world will never be the same. It's not only the fate of Israel that's at stake. Israel's a little country. And if Israel were to disappear tomorrow, the oil crisis would remain. But what the oil crisis should have taught to the world is that none of the existing relationships which we have taken so much for granted can be taken for granted. Europe has been talking of the new Europe. Nationalism was to disappear. There was a common market. So what happened? Somehow in the last month, the little state of Holland displeased the Arab world. And the Arabs said to Holland, you've been a bad boy. You haven't been enough anti-Israel for us. We're cutting off all oil to you. And what did the common market, neighbors and friends and partners of Holland do? They said, sorry, Dutchman, we can't send you any oil because our oil's imports would be threatened. So France and England and Germany turned their back on Holland. And what happened to the North American Treaty Organization under the impact of the oil crisis? This great bulwark of the free world against the expansion of the Soviet Union, this partnership in which we invested so much of our money and time, in which we have put 350,000 of our men and women in uniform every year for the last 25 years. What happened to it? All of a sudden, while we were trying to shore up Israel, West Germany said to some Israeli ships that were put into Hamburg Harbor to get some American tanks to replace the tanks that we lost, sorry, but these ships cannot be loaded with American tanks on German soil. And when America asked for the privilege of flying from NATO bases in Europe, her American supplies to Israel, France, England, Germany said no. Those planes can't take off or overfly from our soil. Greece and Turkey, countries which have depended upon our largesse, said to us, no, your planes can't fly over us. We don't want to be drawn into this particular situation. All of the alliances of the West were thrown into question. And they're thrown into question not only as to the ability of a few medieval sheikdoms to shake the fabric of the West, but what would happen if these sheikdoms fell into the hands of the radical Arab groups tied to the East? How strong would Europe be? The third world controlled the energy which runs its machines and on which its armies have to run. And it's not only geopolitically that this oil crisis has threatened the world, but financially as well. It's estimated that by 1980, At the present levels of production, the Arab states will have profits, money that they simply can't invest in their own domestic economies, equivalent to all the known currencies and gold reserves of the world. We've had two or three runs on gold and the dollar in the last several years, and we use the old phrase of the gnomes of Geneva, the Swiss banks, as the explanation for some of this activity. Much more was to be explained by the activity of Arab finance ministers and sheikhs, pulling out their millions here and investing their hundreds of millions there for a 2 or 3% profit. Imagine if Kuwait and Saudi Arabia and Oman and Abu Dhabi, places you didn't know existed on the map, how many years ago? Places whose combined population couldn't fill Cuyahoga County. Imagine if these countries have income, fiscal clout, sufficient to bring the total economy of the world to a chaotic explosion, to a total standstill, bring the world's economy to its knees. Obviously, the world won't tolerate things getting to that point. But this does give you, does it not, some dimension, some perspective on the dimensions of this oil crisis, to which all of us have been precipitated by short-sightedness, by our love of the affluent society, by the greed of some of our industries, our basic industries, by our own desires to lead the well-oiled life. Now, the business world, or at least some of it, has understood the nature of this oil threat quite clearly and the dangers involved in it. And I've been surprised and encouraged by the fact that some of the most hard-headed of the business journals, the Wall Street Journal and the like, have been talking as the labor unions, the Teamsters, the longshoremen, talk very simply. And they've recognized that if you give in to blackmail once, you will pay through the nose again and again and again, and the cost will only escalate. More and more and more will be demanded of you. But for these United States, the only solution is one which will demand a tightening of our belts, or rather a changing of our habits, and an investment of millions upon billions of tax dollars, of government monies, into research, into a crash program, to what Mr. Nixon called the other night Operation Independence. An operation designed to have the United States politically, energy-wise, independent of blackmail by 1980. Now, this is going to mean sacrifice on your part and on mine. If not direct gasoline rationing, self-rationing. Is this trip necessary? Does every family have to have a car for every person above 16 years of age? Does every family have to have a car which wastes as much gas as the great big American automobiles? Couldn't we get there by rapid transit? Or using our feet? Or even riding a bicycle? And wouldn't it be possible for us next summer to not turn on the air conditioning in our home and open the windows? They're there. And wouldn't it be possible for us to heat our homes to 66 or 68 degrees and sniffle through the winter? We sniffle through the winter anyway. Isn't it possible for us to organize our great office buildings so that the energy, the electrical energy, doesn't have to run from 6 o'clock at night to 6 o'clock in the morning so 20 charwomen can clean the building? And isn't it possible for us to have fine American cities without every piece of steel that's over 3 feet, 3 stories high being illuminated all night long? And wouldn't this be a grand opportunity to do away with all those garish neon signs that wink at us outside? But that's the least of it. That's where the government and the big oil industries are going to come down. But that's not enough. What has to be done, beyond our being much more watchful and much more careful of our appetites, is for industry to be much more careful of its appetites, to be much more willing to reinvest profit into research and development, to be much more willing to produce items which don't gulp down as much electrical energy, to be concerned with the independence of the political and diplomatic stance and posture of the United States, so that we do not put ourselves in the position always of depending upon somebody else's fiscal decisions, so that we have our freedom. I don't know what a country like Japan can do. Japan must ultimately pay whatever the small countries of the world require it her to pay, or else she must engage in another expansion as she did in the 1930s, seeking the oil of Southeast Asia and Indonesia. And we may well see in the Far East or in Europe, countries which are driven to the point that England and France were driven to in 1956 with the closing of the Suez Canal, where they will take what will be called by the Third World imperialist action in order to ensure for themselves domestic oil resource. A country that cannot fly its planes or move its machinery is impotent, and it will starve. There's obviously a point beyond which the Arab states, they're weak, cannot push the states of the West, or Japan, or any other emerging nation. What that point is, none of us can tell. But it's clear that the world is moving into a very dangerous period. Everybody has been frightened. The world of internationalism, of growing free trade between at least economic groups, has been threatened. Think what it means in terms of internationalism for us to have to be talking this morning about the need for American energy independence. It means we don't share as much. We don't engage in certain kinds of joint development consortiums, programs. It means we think of ourselves first. There's value to that, for the free world as well. But there's also danger and a cost in that, which we must be aware. The countries of the world will fall out to fight over who can appease the oil sheik, who can get a special concession, some immediate advantage. It's not going to be a pretty picture. It's not going to be easy for any of us. And whatever happens, this much, it seems to me, is clear. That for the West, the rich, the affluent, the abundant, the time of easy affluence is behind us. Everything is going to cost more because the making of anything is going to cost more. Our ability to work off all of our frustrations by getting in the car and pushing down the gas pedal to the floor, that kind of indulgence is over. There are going to be less cars and more mass transit. There are going to be less buildings and more use of each building. There's going to be more efficient use of machinery. There's going to be more costly energy. All of us are going to tighten our belts. And hopefully at the end of it, the world will have found new sources of energy, perhaps nuclear fission, fusion, which will allow us to maintain decency. But God knows none of us need this indulgence which we've all gone through. And in this process of readjustment and change, all of us are going to have to keep our heads. Think of the pressures that little Israel is under. In this first blush of the oil crisis, somehow seems to be the linchpin. And the easy solution seems to be erase Israel and we'll have the gasoline. Imagine what it means for the Jewish community of these United States. How much of the poison of anti-Semitism will surface when Mr. Jones drives up to this Ohio station and is told you can have only 5 gallons this week because the Middle East oil embargo. Imagine what it means for the free world, these relationships which we have developed with Europe elsewhere, as each country falls to squabbling with itself, with its neighbors, for its share and more of the oil pot. Imagine what it means for the peace of the world if some nations in the world decide they've got to go in and get the oil out themselves. They can't wait for the oil sheikdoms to produce it. I wish I could see the light at the end of the tunnel. For America, I can see the light. The president has laid it out for us. Like Joseph in old, the dream is now of 7 lean years, and then, God willing, we'll have stored up enough energy for some fat years. But what of Western Europe? What of Japan? What of the nations, the underdeveloped nations, which will now find that the cost of developing is almost prohibitive? I guess all that we can say is that we must take each day as it comes. Recognize that we've entered a very, very new world situation. Time of scarcity, time of shortage, a time which requires strength of will and strength of mind.